Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club Podcast. This is your host, Joe Sibilia, and today I am so delighted to be talking with a documentarian, a comedy writer, a historian of the Friars Club. Dean Ward directed and produced this wonderful film called Let Me In, I Hear Laughter, which is really a love letter and the story of the Friars Club right there on film, with so many of the great clips from all of the different Friars roasts and testimonials all the years, interviews with many of the Friars who are now dearly departed, and it's a great film I encourage you to watch. You can find it on YouTube, and I'm sure he'll find other ways to tell you where to find it so that hopefully he can be compensated for the work he did and you're not pirating it. But his name is Dean Ward. Dean, thank you so much for being on the Friars Club Podcast today. How are you? It's a pleasure
to talk to you. Good. Thank you for having me, Joe. Thank you so much. I love what you're doing here, and you've had some amazing guests. I've heard you with Billy Crystal, with Carol Burnett, with Richard Lewis, so I just want to apologize to you and your audience and tell you to lower your expectations accordingly.
No, please. I've wanted you on since the beginning. Now, I was just telling you this before we started. You reached out to me maybe a couple of weeks after the podcast premiered. Yeah. You had somehow found out about it, and I got a very, very congratulatory message from you on Twitter, and it really was high praise coming from you, because I obviously knew about your documentary, and it's been a great resource for me just in doing this show, and it was just such an honor to hear from you, and to know that you've been enjoying what I've been doing really means a lot to me. So thank you for being such a supporter of the Friars Club Podcast and the show.
Yeah. I heard you say in a previous episode that you're 26, which is exactly the age I was in the mid-90s when I started sort of hunting down all these Friars Club legends to do my documentary. So I feel like we're kindred spirits.
Just a little bit. So that's sort of where I want to start out. You were 25 or 26 when you started, I know, doing the film. So which actually came first, the film or you becoming a member of the Friars Club?
Well, here's the funny thing. I didn't intend to become a member of the Friars Club. I only wanted to make the film because I didn't think becoming a member of the Friars Club was possible. I had no show business connections. I came from like a blue collar Boston family, but I was obsessed with show business and watching Carson, and I was obsessed with Frank Sinatra. And I, you know, while my friends were all running off to Beastie Boys concert, I was going to Frank Sinatra concerts as a teenager.
I can relate.
Yeah. So, after I got out of film school, I had spent my teenage years just reading celebrity biographies. That's what I loved. I would read a Carson biography and he would talk about how much he admired Jack Benny. So then I would read a Jack Benny biography, and one thing led to another. And when I was a teenager, Milton Berle wrote a book, you might have read it, called B.S. I Love You, which was all anecdotes from his time as a friar.
Right.
I think there was a heavy emphasis on the B.S. because Milton Berle had a tendency to exaggerate. So I don't know what was true in the book and what wasn't true, but it didn't matter. They were all funny anecdotes. And then George Burns had written a book called All My Best Friends when I was a teenager. That was full of Friars Club stories. And those two books, you know, inspired me to track down a book called Here's to the Friars by Joey Adams. So I just became very obsessed with the Friars Club as this sort of behind closed door, closed enclave where entertainers got together and let their hair down. And of course, the roasts. I loved reading anecdotes about the roasts and what people said behind closed doors about Sinatra and other celebrities I admired. So long story short, when I got out of film school, I moved to California, and I was driving around and there was the Beverly Hills Friars Club, you know, still sitting there. And I thought, it was almost like a ruse. Like, if I could convince them to let me do a documentary about the Friars Club, I could meet and interview all these entertainers that I grew up obsessed with. So why not give it a shot? So I went in, and the membership director greeted me downstairs. And I was funny because at the time I was a temp at DreamWorks. DreamWorks had just started up and I didn't have a full-time job there. I was a temp, but he asked me what I did. And I said, I'm working at DreamWorks right now. I tried to keep it vague. I didn't want to say I was a temp. And Leonard started bringing me around the building and telling everybody, hey, this is Dean Ward. He wants to become a member. He works with Spielberg. You know, he was like,
now, for those who don't know, who is Leonard?
Leonard Penner was not a celebrity. He was a guy who was the membership director of the California Friars Club. And the joke at the time, which I didn't know, was the average age of our members is deceased. So when they saw a young guy come in with any interest in the club, they sent Leonard down right away. So Leonard, I wanted to pitch him the idea of doing a documentary. He wanted to pitch me the idea of joining the club. And we ended up sort of agreeing to both. So it was great. within a visit or two, Leonard brought me over to Milton Berle's table. So I was, you know, hooked right away. It was incredible.
In the documentary, you feature not only the California Friars Club, but you also feature the New York Friars Club. Now, while they're both the Friars Club, anybody who knows a little bit of the history of the Friars Club knows that they were very two distinct factions. So yes. How did the California Friars differ from the New York Friars in your estimation?
Well, that was a very delicate dance to do because I didn't realize that the California Friars Club in the 1940s had a franchise. They basically franchised the name, and the New York Club gave them permission to call themselves the Friars Club of California, and they started holding their old events and roasts out on the West Coast. But they, like you said, they were run completely differently. And over the years, they had started to not get along so well. So it was interesting. I started doing the Friars Club documentary in the West Coast because that's where I was based. But if I wanted to interview Alan King and Henny Youngman and Freddie Roman and all the mainstays of the New York Club, I knew I would have to make inroads there as well. But the clubs hated each other. So the fact that I was working with the California Club made the New York Club very skeptical of me. But eventually I was able to win over a guy named Jean-Pierre Trebeau, who was the executive director of the club at the time. And just like the nicest, classiest guy. And I think the fact that I was young and so passionate, he really took me under his wing, and he introduced me to a guy named Joe Cates, who was a venerable older friar who had a long, illustrious producing and directing career. He's the father of Phoebe Cates from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, for those of you who like that kind of trivia. And and then also a guy named Dave Tebbett, who you might have heard of because he used to run Johnny Carson Productions.
Oh, yes.
And between the three of those guys, they got everybody on New York on board with what I was doing. And I would, you know, once I started, got funding into place for the documentary, because I started filming a documentary with no funding, a guy at DreamWorks who was running the Shoah Foundation, a guy named James Mole, I told him what I was doing. And he said, look, these guys are old. You don't have any time to waste. The Shoah Foundation, for those who don't know, is an effort by Spielberg to record as many testimonials from living Holocaust survivors as he could. And James said, look, it's, you know, not dissimilar to what I'm doing. You have to hurry. This is a race against time. Like Berle and Youngman, these guys aren't going to be around forever. And he introduced me to a cameraman who would work for deferred pay, who was passionate about comedy. And so with this cameraman, Warren Yeager, I just started filming interviews, you know, for the cost of a tape. And so then I started scheduling trips back to New York. Once I had funding in place, we put together what's now called a sizzle reel. I don't think that term existed back then, but HBO gave us the finishing funds, and I was able to go back to New York and film Alan King and Henny Youngman and Freddie Roman and all the folks back there. And the New York Club even let me film some events, which was a big honor because they rarely let people do that. I got to film, you know, backstage at the John Travolta tribute that they did, John Travolta and Kelly Preston, and a Danny Aiello roast that they had. So they really gave me full access, and they opened the archives to me and gave me full access to the archives. Like they had all these tapes of the Billy Crystal roast and the Bruce Willis roast that they had done, sort of just bootleg tapes that they had recorded on their own, and they allowed me access to those. So they were really gracious, and I was very grateful. And when the documentary was done, I got the nicest letter from, like, you know, signed by Alan King and Freddie Roman, giving me an honorary membership into the club, like a lifetime honorary membership, which was just like beyond my belief.
So from start to finish, how long did it take to actually put the documentary together?
It was about 5 years. It took up like most of my 20s, and it was a real obsession. Like I was working full time always. I got hired full time at DreamWorks at a certain point. I wasn't a temp any longer. And so I was working, you know, crazy hours just in my regular daytime show business job. And then every other minute was the Friars Club documentary. I'd get home at night and I would write letters to various people to try to get interviews. And I was doing archival research and putting together sizzle reels. And so I would say it took almost like 2 years just to get the concept going and try to pitch it a few places. And then there was about a year where I was just filming interviews again with that camera person who very graciously agreed to work for free temporarily. And I started banking those interviews, and then I put together a sizzle reel. So all said and done, I started in like 95, and the film, I think, premiered in 99. It was like a 4-year journey. And there were certain comedians that I really was like, you really had to seduce them. It took a long, long time to get Berle to sit down for an interview and certain other comedians.
Well, I was going to get to that. So who exactly was the first person that you got on film for the documentary? Was it Milton Berle who was the first one you got done?
It was not Milton Berle. Milton Berle was one of the last. It's very funny.
That's interesting.
It was, I was brought over to Milton Berle's table, like I said, like within my first or second visit to the club. And he was hilarious. As soon as I walked over, as you know, the club has a reputation for being predominantly Jewish, but it's not a Jewish club by any means. And then Leonard said, "Milton, this is Dean Ward." And he said, "Ward, that doesn't sound Jewish. Who let you in here? I hope at least you're circumcised." Like he just launched into roasting me, you know? And then he asked me where I was from. And I said, "Massachusetts, a town called Brookline." And he goes, "Oh, I know Brookline. I used to play the vaudeville theaters in Boston, and I used to do a lot of stupping in Brookline." he didn't say stupping. I cleaned that up for you, but it was, you know, I can't tell you how depressing it is to hear from a guy in his late 80s that he had more sex in your hometown than you did. But, you know, Milton Berle had certain endowments that we all don't have, you know, so he had an advantage for sure.
That's great.
But yeah, so Milton, he was very supportive of the idea. And he was also a very accessible guy. As I became a member and started hanging out at the California Club, if there was an empty seat at his table, you could just go sit. And if he was in a good mood, he would regale you with stories for hours and hours about show business. But every time, it was interesting, every time I tried to nail him down to schedule an interview, he'd say, "Oh, I've got this going on. Hit me up in July. Try me again in October. Try me." And this went on for like years and years. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I think what it was actually is, in retrospect, I think he was getting older. He was in his late 80s, and he would perform at the club on certain nights and events and get up and just kill and destroy. But it was material, like 10 minutes of material that he was very, very comfortable with, that he had been doing for decades and knew inside and out. And I honestly think like the idea of being interviewed and having to recall dates and things like that intimidated him a little bit at that age. And he was maybe in a little bit of a vulnerable place as an older guy and didn't want to look stupid. So I think the fact that he was avoiding the documentary was coming from more of a place of like sort of insecurity, which I didn't realize at the time. To me, it was just incredibly frustrating. But eventually he had a writing partner that used to sit with him every day at the club named Buddy Arnold, who had been working with him all the way dating back to like the Texaco Star Theater days. And I tried every angle to get Milton to do an interview, and I started having his friends work on him for me. So Buddy eventually convinced Milton to do the interview, but Milton would only do the interview if Buddy was asking the questions. So we did the interview. Buddy sat across from Milton. I was feeding questions. I was kneeling next to Buddy Arnold, feeding questions to Buddy Arnold. He was feeding the questions to Milton Berle, and we got through the interview, and it was great. And Berle was great.
You wouldn't have been able to tell from the documentary.
It was quite an experience. And the funny thing is, Berle was like very, very crotchety guy in general. I mean, if you got him on a good day, like I said, he'd tell you stories endlessly. But if you caught him at a bad moment, he could be very kind of gruff and grumpy. So we ended up having a premiere of the documentary at the club in California, and I invited all the Friars. I didn't know who would show up, and lo and behold, Berle showed up that night, and it was amazing. And they had cocktails and appetizers, and then we rolled the film. And when the film was over, it got a standing ovation, and one of Burl's cronies came running up to me and said, "Milton wants to see you. Milton wants to see you." And I was terrified because Berle had never seen a rough cut or anything, and it had cursing in it. And there was a couple anecdotes in the film that kind of portrayed Berle as a little bit of a pain in the ass in a funny way, which I didn't know how he would take. And anyway, so this crony drags me over to Milton, and Milton stands up and grabs me by the shoulders, and I don't know what's about to come. And then he kissed me on both cheeks, and he like loved the movie, and it was just the greatest moment ever to like be, you know, kissed on the cheeks at your premiere at the Friars Club by Milton Berle.
You met Milton Berle early on at the Friars Club. When you would go in those early days and hang out at the California Friars Club, who were some of the people that were populating the dining room at the time, and who were some of the people that would hang out there in those days?
It's very funny because I used to describe it to people as like an interactive Hollywood theme park for an old show business guy. And, you know, like people would call these guys dinosaurs, you know, show business dinosaurs. And I was like, great, if they're dinosaurs, then this is my Jurassic Park. I'm going to go and I'm going to go see the dinosaurs. I'm going to go in. And so like literally you could be riding the elevator and Tony Martin would be standing next to you. And like Tony Martin's not a name that's widely known today, but he was a big star at MGM in the 1940s. He'd been in movies with the Marx Brothers. He's, you know, I once was in the gym at the Friars Club, and it was two people in the gym, me and Shecky Green. You know, I was like,
how much did a Shecky bench press?
I don't know. I never met him in the steam room. So I didn't, you know, we didn't get that intimate, but I saw him working out for sure. And then Steve Allen, when I was inducted into the club, he was, you know, presided over the pinning ceremony.
And Steve had been the abbot of the club at one point.
Right, Steve was the abbot of
the California
club. Yeah, and then they would have events all the time, and you never knew who would show up. Schwarzenegger would show up. I remember one time John Bon Jovi came with Schwarzenegger to a cigar night, and they were introducing his table. And, you know, because it was the Friars Club, they were older guys and they weren't totally hip to new show business people. So they were like, at this table, we have Arnold Schwarzenegger and John Bon Jovi. Like, they just got the name wrong. They had no idea who he was. Jeff Ross was around a lot at that time. You know, he was another young guy that really loved the club. And so he was mostly a New York Friar, but when he was in L.A., he would always stop by the California Club. Norm Crosby, Jack Carter, Red Buttons, Phyllis Diller, they would all be not on a regular daily basis for like lunch, but you'd see them at the club at events and things like that. Rickles, I saw at an event once, which was like the thrill of a lifetime because I had seen him open for Sinatra and just couldn't love Rickles more.
So I thought it was interesting in watching the documentary that Don Rickles wasn't in the documentary. Did you ask for Don Rickles to be
Don
in the
Rickles
movie?
Was the one that got away. I tried every angle to get Don Rickles. Dave Tebbett wrote a letter to Don Rickles for me and I just couldn't get him. And he had just made Casino and Toy Story, and I think he was riding high at a new level, like working with Scorsese and De Niro.
Right.
And he just didn't want to be bothered sitting down for an annoying interview with some young kid, I think, what it was. But it broke my heart because I really loved Rickles, and I saw him perform so many times, every chance I could get. And but the nice thing was, when the film was done, I had to get permission. I had to get everybody who was in any clip in any way whatsoever in the documentary to sign a release form. And Rickles signed a release form to allow me to use some clips of his roasting and different material that was in the documentary. So I know he was at least aware of the documentary and he supported it at that level. And that was kind of, I had to take that and for what it was.
Well, see, that's nice. I saw him maybe a year or two before he passed away. He was performing in Valley Forge.
Yeah.
And it was a surreal experience in that it was a little sad in a way because he was so diminished physically. Yeah, you know, he was confined to a chair. He didn't even sound all that great. Like, his voice was kind of hoarse and gravelly, I remember. But just to be in the same room as Don Rickles, it's like sitting in a room with a titan.
It's true. That's what the Friars Club was. All the, you know, you're like, I can't believe I'm breathing the same air as these people. These people I read about my whole life. You know, it's just incredible.
Exactly. Now, I know another person who you tried mightily to get to do the documentary was one of the most beloved comedians, and I say that a little bit facetiously, and that was Joey Bishop, who was known to be a little bit prickly.
Yes.
How did you even get in contact with him at this point? Because by this time, he largely had abandoned the show business game. He was enjoying retirement, playing golf in Newport Beach and that sort
of thing.
So how did you even get in touch with him in the first place? And how did you sort of befriend him, even though he didn't do the documentary?
Well, that was really interesting. And he was a gruff guy, but like a lovable guy. And I'm so grateful that he took a liking to me because he was sweet to me overall. He was a very sweet guy underneath his gruffness. I got his number from a journalist who had written a profile about him in the LA Times. And this is an example of how gruff Joey Bishop was. I talked to Joey Bishop. I told him I got your number from so-and-so, this journalist. We had a nice chat. I found out years later, the fact that journalist gave me his phone number, Joey Bishop called and reamed that journalist and never spoke to him again.
I've read that piece before. I figured that was you, but so I had read that many years ago.
He continued talking to me, but I didn't realize I had burned the bridge for this poor journalist who had developed a nice relationship with him, and I felt terrible. But it was interesting. I called him. We had a nice chat, and he said, look, for personal reasons, I can't get into it. I don't want to tell you why. I can't do the documentary. I've had a bad experience with the Friars Club. I don't want to talk about it. I can't do it. I wish you well. And what I would do in those cases is I was very persistent. I would try to win people over. So I would try to send them a rare photograph or something I found in my research that would sort of woo them and lure them back in. So I found a Life magazine spread from 1972 where Joey Bishop had emceed in New York a roast of Jack Benny and George Burns. They roasted them together. And Joey Bishop was the roast master, and I knew he idolized Benny and Burns. So I got a copy of that off of eBay or wherever I got it, and I sent it to him. And he was touched that I had sent him that, and he called me. And he said, look, I still can't do the documentary. I can't tell you why, but come down to Newport. I'll show you some stuff. And so I drove down to Newport on a Saturday, and it was like Joey Bishop, like, hosted me the whole day. It was like going to the Joey Bishop Museum. He like took me into his library where he had all his leather bound scripts, and he showed me pictures from when he was one of the MCs at JFK's inaugural, and you know, he walked over to a book that was a book of interviews with famous comedians, and he turned to the chapter with Jack Benny, and he knew exactly what page to go, and he read, you know, Jack Benny talking about who his favorite young comedian was, and of course it was Joey Bishop. Like he knew exactly where to go to read me all this stuff to impress me. He didn't need to impress me, but it was sweet. It was very charming. And then we went to his living room, and he started showing me VHS tapes. He just wanted to sort of show me stuff. And I remember he showed me an episode of his talk show where I think Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford were the guests. And then he showed me a clip of a Frank Sinatra show where he and Nancy Sinatra Jr. and Elvis Presley were the guests. And he showed me a special he did with Jimmy Durante. And it was like going to the Museum of Broadcasting with Joey Bishop. And he was just showing me like his whole career. And it got to be about 6 o'clock. It was funny. And I was, you know, Joey, you're so generous with your time. I don't want to take up any more of your time. And he said, one second, give me a second. And he went into the kitchen and I could hear him and his wife kind of whispering. And he came back out into the living room and he said, well, look, you can't tell anybody because we didn't buy enough fish. But if we split the two portions into three, will you stay and have dinner with us? And I was like, well, of course, I don't want to impose. But if you're inviting me to dinner, I'll stay and have dinner with the last surviving member of the Rat Pack. Of course I will. Yeah, sure. And so I ended up having dinner with Joey Bishop and his wife in their kitchen in Newport Beach. It was very nice. And then when dinner was over, the funny thing was he finished his last bite and he got up without saying a word, went back to the living room. And Mrs. Bishop said, oh, Joey loves Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. They're his favorite shows. He's going out to watch Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. So now it's 7 o'clock when those start. I go out and I say, Joey, I have to go. You've been so generous. He goes, nonsense. Sit down. Watch Wheel of Fortune with me. So I'm sitting there watching Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. We're high-fiving each other when we get answers right. It was crazy. It was the most insane day ever. And then we developed like a friendship. He would call me and tell me stories. And he would tell, because he was getting older, he would sometimes repeat stories and then he would get, you know, forget details. And I could sort of fill in the gaps for him because I had heard the stories before. And he'd be like, I don't understand how you know all this. And I didn't want to tell him, well, you've told me this story 5 or 6 times before, because I just loved hearing the stories. And then one day, a tube came in the mail, like one of those poster tubes. And I opened it up and it was a picture of the Rat Pack in front of the Sands, that famous picture. And Joey Bishop signed it to me. And he said, Dean, are you sure you weren't there? Which was just like the highest compliment. I still treasure that. It's like hanging in my office.
Oh, that's great. I was always a fan of his. I always thought he was really funny. And you did get some really cool footage of him at different Friars events in the documentary, which I thought was nice. Now, this is something I'm always curious about because you had went to his house. What was the house like? I'm always fascinated to hear about celebrity homes.
The house was beautiful. It was right on an area of Newport Beach called Lido Island. And I remember he walked me in and right out the back, there was like sliding glass doors to whatever that, you know, whatever the water is called down there. I don't know if it's a bay or a harbor or whatever, Newport Harbor probably, but just a beautiful view. And he said, Buddy Hackett came down here and told me one time my backyard is a postcard. And it was just a beautiful view of the water. And the house itself was nice as well.
Very now you nice. Got Buddy Hackett in the documentary as well.
I got Buddy Hackett. Yeah, the New York Friars Club helped me get Buddy Hackett because it's interesting. Buddy Hackett had developed a distaste for the California Friars Club. He didn't want anything to do with the California Friars Club, so I had to get to him through the New York Club.
Did you find out why?
He hated, it's funny, I've even seen him talk about it on Johnny Carson Tonight Show. He hated smoking, and he wouldn't go anywhere where there was cigar smoking, and I guess there was less of it in the New York Club in those days, I'm not sure, but if anybody lit up a cigar at the California Club, he wouldn't go inside. He was very anti-smoking, and then he just, I think there were several personalities there he didn't mix well with, and he just didn't want anything to do with it. George Jessel, I think, had pissed him off. And then I think now I'm remembering a guy named George Jessel, a famous comedian, had pissed him off at some point in the 1970s.
Toastmaster General.
Yeah, he hated George Jessel, now I'm remembering. I think that sort of soured him on the California Club. He eventually came back in the 90s as an older guy. Somebody brought him back into the fold, and he started showing up at events there, and he came around. But when I interviewed him, he didn't like the California Club at all. So we interviewed him at his house in Beverly Hills. And he was another funny one, just the funniest guy probably I ever met. Just not only as a comedian, but just one of those people that just thinks funny. And I had sent him a letter and a sizzle reel to try to kind of get him on board. And the sizzle reel was like an 8-minute tape of interviews with, you know, of the people we had interviewed thus far, Norm Crosby and Jack Carter and whatever. And he called me. I was at my desk at DreamWorks, I remember, and the phone rings. It's like it was like the newest new Hollywood place you could work. And suddenly, yeah. Buddy Hackett's on the phone. It was like, what's happening? But he said, I got your letter and I got your tape. He goes, the tape, it was perfect. 8 minutes. The shorter, the better. If it was 7 minutes, I would have kissed you. If it was 6 minutes, I would have hugged you. And if it was 5 minutes, I would have fucked you. Like right off the bat, he's just Buddy Hackett. You know, I pardon my language, but I, you know, Buddy worked for Lou. I had to quote him exactly. So he agreed to an interview and we showed up at his house and he opened the door. He was in his pajama bottom still and like a kind of ratty golf t-shirt that maybe he slept in. I don't know. And he looked at me. We'd only corresponded through the mail and on the phone. And he said, wow, you're a young schmuck. That was his greeting at the door. And he welcomed us in. We did a great interview. And then the funny thing was when the interview was over, he kind of wanted to hang out. But what he didn't know is I was still working at DreamWorks at the time. And my boss at DreamWorks was very supportive of the documentary. He was a director who was a comedy fan and he loved that I was doing it. But I had kind of like used up all my favors. So I said I was at the dentist and I ran to Buddy Hackett's house to do this interview. And I was like, I have to get back to work, but I couldn't tell Buddy Hackett I had to get back to work. He jumps behind his bar. He starts making fresh lemonade for me and the cameraman. Then he sits down and starts telling us about stories about Carson and Sinatra. He starts to give us a tour of the house. At one point he says, he stops in front of a closet and he says, this is in case of an earthquake. And he opens the door and it's like a whole floor to ceiling of Absolute bottle, vodka bottles. And then he says, do you want to see the power of the Torah? He takes us into his living room. There's a Torah in the living room and he lifts up the Torah. He says, you want to see the power of the Torah? Lifts it up. There's a gun underneath. He's like a crazy person in a funny way. It's just really delightfully funny and a wild man like you would hope.
I had heard he had like an arsenal in his home. He was very big into guns.
He was very big into guns. Yeah, he was. And then he had a very famous statue out front of an elephant that I think he had gotten when he was on safari in Africa or something like that. And it's still there to this day. If you pass his house on Whittier Drive in Beverly Hills, that statue is there. And he said, come outside, we'll take a picture. Everybody wants to see the elephant. And so we took a picture in front of the elephant.
Now I know when I go out there, forget the Hollywood sign. I need to see the Buddy Hackett elephant.
The Buddy Hackett elephant. Yeah, exactly.
I want to go through some of the other names of some of the people you got for the documentary to be interviewed on camera. Steve Allen, of course, you said you met early on. Yes. What were your memories of Steve Allen?
Steve Allen was a kind of a fixture at the club at that time. He was interesting because he was a very serious guy. He was a very funny guy, obviously, when he performed, but he was kind of bookish and serious and reserved. And you've probably experienced this when you're doing the documentary, but sometimes when you're interviewing somebody and you're young, they're skeptical of you because they've had all kinds of experiences where a young person doesn't know their history and, you know, slights them in some way. So when I started interviewing him, I could tell he was just sort of giving me rote answers, and they were good answers, but he wasn't really warming up. And I found out with him and Alan King and a few other guys, if you could find a way to work in some detail that showed what a dork you were for this stuff, you know, you could really win them over. So at one point, Steve Allen mentioned a comedian named Frank Fay, which is a very obscure name, but he was a monologist in yes, vaudeville that Jack Benny idolized. And he was the lead in Harvey, the Jimmy Stewart movie, Harvey, when that was a Broadway play. Frank Fay was the lead in Harvey. He was a big, big deal, but also like the nastiest guy in show business. Everybody hated him, but they all admired him as a comedian. And so at some point he mentioned Frank Fay, and I said, because I had read so many show business biographies ago, I said, oh, my favorite comment about Frank Fay is Fred Allen said one time, you could fit the friends of Frank Fay into a phone booth while Kate Smith is making a call. making a phone call. And, you know, you can't make that joke today because you're basically fat shaming Kate Smith, who was an overweight singer. I saw Steve Allen's kind of eyes light up and he was like, shit, this kid knows who Frank Fay is. And the whole interview changed. He just like came to life, and the interview lasted like 90 minutes. And he was just after that, I think he realized, oh, I'm in capable hands. This kid isn't just the typical idiot that doesn't know anything about anything.
How did you decide to put Art Linkletter in the documentary? I don't even know if too many people remember Art Linkletter today, but he was a television host who had a daytime television series called House Party on CBS for many years, and he popularized that segment, Kids Say the Darndest Things,
right. Yes.
Where he interviewed little children. But he also had membership in the Friars Club. So how did you hook up with Art Linkletter?
I specifically wanted Art Linkletter because there's a very, very famous story in the history of the California Friars Club, which you may have heard, about a comedian named Harry Einstein, who went by the stage name of Parkiacarcus.
Yes, Albert Brooks' father, for those who...
The father of Albert Brooks and Super Dave Osborne. Yeah, exactly. And there's a famous roast in 1958, I believe, of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. And it was at the Beverly Hilton. And Art Linkletter was the MC of that particular roast. And there's audio of it, it exists. There's no video, but there's audio of the entire roast. Harry Einstein was a radio comedian, started on the Eddie Cantor Show, and then eventually got his own show under this, the name of Park Iacakis. He played a character that had sort of a Greek dialect, and a very, very funny guy. And by all accounts, like the funniest guy off stage you could ever want to meet, like just brilliant, brilliant mind. As you can imagine, when you give birth to Albert Brooks, whoever gives birth to Albert Brooks is a funny guy in his DNA as well, obviously, right? The best. So at this particular evening, Art Linkletter introduces Harry Einstein to get up and perform, and Harry Einstein gets up and just destroys the audience. He was they all loved him behind the scenes at the Friars Club. And he did a whole routine about how hard it was to get into the Friars Club, but his jokes were stuff like, you have to be sponsored by at least one person who is either listed or not listed in the phone book. Like he did a whole thing about how like hard it was to get in the Friars Club, but then all the criteria was really just bullshit. And he did great. And anyway, he finished his act, got a standing ovation, went back, sat down at the dais next to Milton Berle, and he had a heart attack and died. And so it became this very famous story, and Art Linkletter was one of the people that was there. Berle was one of the people that was there. There was another guy, Barry Merkin, who produced the night, who I interviewed, who was there. And so that was my main reason for wanting to interview Art Linkletter, that he was a firsthand witness to this very, very famous story in the club's history.
Now, there was a name that you've brought up multiple times, Dave Tebbutt, who, as you mentioned, was an executive with Carson Productions, and before that was sort of the head of the talent relations department at NBC. I think that's right. the best way to describe his role. How did you get in touch with Dave Tebbutt, and how did you even find out about him to begin with? Was he somebody you knew about when you first started your documentary on the Friars Club?
I knew his name for sure, because I knew he was the entertainment director at the Friars Club in New York for many years, which... that title meant basically that you brought in the talent to produce the events and the roasts. And not only did the club do roasts, but they also did big kind of charity dinners that were not, X-rated.
Testimonials.
Testimonial dinners.
Sort.
Yes. Thank you. And so he produced a very famous Harry Grant testimonial dinner that Frank Sinatra was the MC of. And Frank Sinatra sang a beautiful song parody paying tribute to Cary Grant. And there's audio of that that's in the documentary.
The most beautiful guy in the world isn't me, no, isn't Dino, but as we know, it's the man that we honor tonight.
I usually sit in the second row behind the MC and the guest of honor. Cary never wanted to be in front of a live audience and make speeches or talks or whatever. He was, because he was afraid of it, which is nothing to be ashamed of.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Cary Grant.
He got up to talk, and he started to cry.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I don't know how I can follow all that, and probably won't please you at all, but there you are. But you see, I'm still tearful from Frank singing his song to me.
Of all my years in this business, I don't ever remember an audience standing up and screaming their heads off and crying with them. I never saw anything like it before.
And he was just very good friends with major, major talent. He was good friends with Cary Grant and Carson. He ran, like you said, he ran Carson Productions. And so I think Jean-Pierre Tribault said, you should talk to Dave Tebbutt. And so I ended up interviewing Dave because of that Cary Grant event. I wanted to get his thoughts on that and other events that he had done. And he had a nice time doing it. And when it was over, he said, how can I help you? And because of his talent relations, I said, well, there's several people I haven't been able to get to. If there's anybody you know that I'm on this list of people I want to interview, please, anything you could do, I would really appreciate it. And he started taking me out to lunch. We would go to a place called Kate Manolini's in Beverly Hills. And he became kind of like an advisor, and he took me under his wing. And eventually he sent some letters to some stars. And I remember about a week later, Sid Caesar, who I'd been after for a million years, suddenly, because he got a letter from Dave Tebbutt, showed up at the club and agreed to an interview, and I was sitting down opposite Sid Caesar, which was just a dream. So that
now,
was
Sid Caesar a difficult guy to talk to? Because I know he's one of those people who, when he was on stage, totally comfortable as a character, but if he had to speak as himself, you couldn't get a word out of him.
He was a very shy, reserved guy, and he was somebody you would see at the club occasionally for lunch, And he had a lot of back pain at that time. He had sciatica, I think. And he was a guy that was always in very good shape his whole life. He worked out incessantly and he was strong as a bull, but the sciatica had really taken its toll on him. And you would see him getting in and out of chairs very painfully. But yes, like speaking to your point, yes, he was very, very shy. So he showed up and he was a hard guy to kind of get to warm up. And I remember when I interviewed him, people from the club kind of gathered around and were watching the interview go down because it was rare to see him there talking about his career and that sort of thing. And I remember this is on YouTube. It's an outtake from the documentary. But if you go to YouTube and you look up Sid Caesar Double Talk, there's an outtake from the film. Because what Sid Caesar would do at a roast, he didn't do typical roast material. He had this foreign language double talk routine that he would do, where he would roast the people in various languages, and he could pick up the cadence of any language and pretend to be speaking in Japanese or German or Italian or French. And it's something that he used to do on your Show of Shows and in various sketches throughout his career. And he adapted that to be a Friars Club routine that he would do. And so I asked him about that, and I read a quote from the New York Times where he did that at a Neil Simon roast in New York. And he just launched into it, and he started doing his double talk routine while I was interviewing him. And I remember when the interview wrapped, there was a guy there who's like, I can't believe you got him to do that. Like, Sid Caesar doesn't, you know, he never opens up. Like, basically, somehow, over the course of the interview, he opened up and warmed up, and we got great stuff out of him.
I thought so. I thought he was very well spoken in the documentary. It was it was really nice to see him in the film. Also, somebody who was nice to see was Ed McMahon.
I couldn't get Carson. Carson was retired at that point, and I'd corresponded with Carson, and his secretary would always get back to me and say, "Oh, Johnny's not doing anything anymore. He spends a lot of time on his boat, and you know, he just wasn't working." There was a nice follow up to that. A guy named Phil Rosenthal, who's a big showrunner and a talent in his own right. He has a show on Netflix now called Everybody Feeds Phil. He got a copy of the documentary when it was finished to Johnny Carson, and Carson watched it, which was exciting. But Ed McMahon I got because he had been involved in many, many Friars Club events over the years. He had been roasted himself at the California Club, and he had emceed various events. I think he emceed even a Frank Sinatra roast or something at one point. So he had a lot of Friars Club history that wasn't that well known, but he had certainly been at a lot of events and he could speak to certain things. And he told some anecdotes about seeing Jack Benny at roasts, and these comedians who you thought kind of traditionally worked clean and you didn't know that they would tell X-rated jokes, and Jack Benny and George Burns. And he remembered being at certain events where those guys were working very, very dirty, and how fun that was when you were a young guy seeing those kind of heroes work blue at a Friars Club roast.
Another colorful character who was in the documentary, who I interviewed once when I was doing a radio show in college, that was the incomparable Pat Cooper.
Oh, yes. Pat Cooper was another one of those guys where his persona was that, and he could turn that on, but also a sweetheart, like just the sweetest guy in the world. We interviewed him in Las Vegas, and I remember he said, "My house is hard to find. Meet me at this gas station on the corner of whatever and whatever, and I'll guide you in." So we go and we show up at this, you know, I don't even know, a Unocal gas station on some corner in Las Vegas. And then Pat Cooper pulls up in a convertible or whatever he was driving, and he's like, "Follow me." And we just followed Pat Cooper back into this residential neighborhood, and we parked in his driveway and we got out. And he was great. He was fantastic. And the film eventually got into the Las Vegas Film Festival, and he showed up for that. And he was like very supportive of the film. And I think he may have even talked about it on the Howard Stern show, which I appreciated because I was a huge Howard Stern fan, and that was a thrill to know that it got mentioned there. Another guy, it's funny, I don't know if I told you this before, but Jerry Lewis is another guy I couldn't get. And Jerry Lewis,
I was going to ask you why, because later he became the abbot of the club in New York.
Yeah, he was the abbot of the club in New York. I caught Jerry Lewis, I don't know what it was, I caught him at a bad time because I sent him a letter. And Dave Tebbett even helped me try to get Jerry Lewis, and we couldn't make it work. But I sent him a letter, and I pride myself in sort of writing very sincere letters, and they usually work. I mean, most of the people I wrote to called me back and eventually did an interview. So I wrote Jerry Lewis a letter, and I get a voicemail. "Dean Ward, Jerry Lewis, 702-555-6239. Call me." Click. And I was like, holy shit. I think I'm going to get an interview with Jerry Lewis. Why would he be calling me himself? You know, he's got people. He doesn't need to call me himself. This is exciting. So I call Jerry Lewis back, and he proceeds to just go on a tirade He just, I don't know, you know, maybe it's, maybe the fact that my name was Dean triggered him and it brought him memories of his feud with Dean Martin. I have no idea, but he want, you know, he was very insistent that he didn't do this kind of thing unless if he was paid $10,000. And I tried to, you know, I tried to explain it was a passion project and he wasn't hearing it. And he said, you know, I know these things, these passion projects, they all have money and I've been taken advantage of so many times over the years. And he said, I'm a big boy. I know how to protect myself. And I was like, this is getting weird. So anyway, I hung up, he hung up rather. And this was during a period, maybe in his defense, I remember he was on prednisone and that can make you crazy. So in his defense, maybe he was a lovely guy when he wasn't on prednisone. I don't know, but I had a very bad call with, and then I got off the phone and I was like, he just doesn't understand what a passion project this is. I'm like breaking even on this thing. I'm not making money. Nobody's getting rich. It's just like this weird hobby I have. And so I wrote him a letter and really poured my heart out. And I faxed it through to his office in Las Vegas. And 5 minutes later, my letter came back through the fax machine, faxed back to me. And they wrote in like a big Sharpie on my letter, what is it about no that you don't understand? So I, at that point, I gave up on Jerry Lewis, which is a shame because there's very good footage of a 1955 roast of Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin that Marilyn Monroe attended. And it was a spectacular dais and one of the most famous events in the club, at the club, from that period of like the mid 50s when Martin Lewis were really at their height. So I really wanted to talk to him and it's a shame I didn't get to.
And you can hear some of that audio in the Dina Martin episode of this podcast.
Okay.
Dina was on. That was a great newsreel that they put together. This
yes.
was back when they had newsreels before yeah. you had Walter Cronkite on television. You go to the movies and you'd watch the news. One of my favorite moments in the documentary is, I don't know, were you doing this right before they did a roast of Hugh Hefner? This couldn't have been the one that aired on Comedy Central that the Friars did right after 9/11. This must have been one they did for him in California. But Red Buttons was going through the material he was going to do at that roast, and he was dressed in a tuxedo. Did you interview him backstage
no,
at this event?
No, that's the funny thing about Red Buttons. He was another guy, did not want to do the documentary. He
really?
Red Buttons... He's an Oscar winner. He won an Oscar for Sayonara. So I think
right.
in Red Buttons' mind, he was at a higher level than these other comedians I was interviewing. He was an Oscar winner. He, you know, he always wanted to know who else is doing it, who else is doing it. And he held out until the very end and I drove him crazy. And he's another guy I would constantly send stuff to try to impress him. I found like an old program for something called the Friars Frolics, which was a show the New York Club used to produce back in the 1940s. And he was on the bill of that. And I came up to him at an event at the club back, you know, backstage, and I handed him that, and he was in the midst of writing his memoirs, and he was doing a one-man show on Broadway called Buttons on Broadway, and he looked at it and he was like, oh, I'm gonna use this, is great, I'm writing my memoir, thank you so much, I didn't know about this, thank you. And so he was great. You know, there was little moments where I thought, okay, I'm gonna get him, and I couldn't get him. He just wouldn't do it. Finally he agreed to do it and we set a time, and it was towards the end. He might have been like the last one right before we did Burl. And we filmed it at the club, and it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He shows up in his tuxedo and he's like, well, after all this time, all this hassle of you bothering me, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to wear a tuxedo and do it right. You know, so he came in his full tuxedo, which was, I thought, really sweet. And yes, like you said, we started interviewing him. And then he said, we've got this roast of Hugh Hefner coming up. Let me show you what I do. And he pulled out his index cards that he would use on the dais of a roast. And he just started going through the roast jokes that he was going to do. And I remember he had one that kills me to this day. He said,
a man who made it possible for premature ejaculators to get Playboy a week early. That's the kind of man that we're giving to. You get the idea?
The thing I admired about Red Buttons is when he did a Friars roast, he always had fresh material. He always would work current references into that Never Got a Dinner routine whenever he performed at the Friars. He didn't just lean back on the stuff he had been doing over and over again for years. His interview was great. And I have an outtake from that, which was very funny because when it ended, he goes, okay, Dean, are we done now? Are you going to leave me alone? Can I go on with my life? He started roasting me about how bad I had bothered him to do the interview.
So you've mentioned some of these different Friars events. As a Friar, aside from the documentary, what have been some of the events that you've had the good fortune of attending? I know you mentioned the John Travolta and Kelly Preston testimonial in New York. I know you were at that.
Yes.
So what were some of the other ones that you got to go to over the years?
There's a Mickey Rooney roast at the California Club, which was just incredible. You're backstage at that, and there's Buddy Hackett in one corner talking to somebody, and then you look over across the room and you're like, is that Mickey Rooney talking to Ann Miller? Like, you know, just like these stars from, you couldn't believe the people you were looking at. I went to the Kelly Preston one. I remember being backstage at that one, and I looked over and, like, in the corner, Anthony Hopkins, Lauren Bacall, and Shirley MacLaine are huddling and having a conversation. You're just like, what is happening here? Where am I? There was also just like smaller events at the club, which would sound like nothing, but they were magical. Like, you would go to a night and it would be like Milton Berle's 90th birthday party or something. And Tony Martin would get up and sing three songs. And he was like almost 90, but sounded like he was like in his prime. And Red Buttons would get up and Sid Caesar would get up. And those were like little small intimate gatherings at the California Friars Club, just in their dining room. So you were like really up close and personal with these like major, major show business figures. Those were the nights I really treasured.
You describe in an article that you had sent me, the California Friars Club, as similar to the movie Casino and its decor. How would you compare the actual California Club building to that of the monastery in New York? How would you compare and contrast the two?
Well,
in terms of their aesthetic.
Yeah, the New York Club is just this beautiful, you know, brownstone townhouse, I guess you would call it. It's just opulent and incredible, and just one of the, just a building where you just feel steeped in history the second you walk in the door. The California Club, when they were founded in the 1940s by a bunch of movie stars, including like Bing Crosby and George Raft and George Burns and all these various people, they didn't have a clubhouse right away. They kind of like squatted in various other clubs for a while. And then they had some sort of building fund, and Sinatra was, I think, integral in raising the money to create their own building in Beverly Hills. And I think it was maybe they broke ground in like 62 and the building opened in like 64. I might not be exactly right on those dates, but they didn't have a building until the 60s, but they had existed prior to that, and they had events and roasts and stuff prior to that, but they didn't have that building until the 60s. And so it kind of had a mid-century vibe. It was a big kind of like whale of a building with no windows. It was completely enclosed. There was no windows, no daylight inside at all. It was almost like being inside a casino in that respect. And you walked into a lobby. There was a parking garage underneath. You'd go up a sort of circular staircase and you'd enter the dining room. There was a bar to the left and a big sort of banquet hall dining room to the right. And there was red leather banquettes. And it looked like, you know, like something out of a Scorsese movie, those kind of red leather banquettes. And there was a little small stage. And then back further past that was the gym and the steam room and the massage rooms and all that kind of stuff. And then on the very top floor, there was a card room where people played gin rummy. And Tony Martin was a big gin rummy player. So he'd often be up there. But you could also have lunch up there. And I liked having lunch up there. You'd sort of eat at a card table. And it was kind of funny to eat lunch in the card room. And that was basically it. That was how the California Club was sort of broken down.
And it's a shame that they demolished that building after the club closed. And
they did.
It's a piece of history lost forever. But fortunately, very well preserved in your documentary. You get some great footage of both the New York and the California Friars Club. So when you were doing the film, how difficult was it to piece together the history of the club? Because so little of it is really out on the public record. There's a couple of books out there, but that's about it. And those books are largely about the New York Club. And doing this podcast, even though I'm doing it for the New York Friars Club, I did want to make an effort to also chronicle the history of the California Club solely because of that reason. There's so little information out there about it. I want all information about anything Friars. What was the difficulty you faced in doing research for the film?
Well, like I said, there was that book by Joey Adams. That was certainly great. I hit a lot of archives and libraries. I would find stuff in weird ways. Like, I remember there was a biography of Irving Berlin, and it mentioned in the biography that, you know, it was a custom back at the time when he joined the Friars Club back in the days of George M. Cohan to give a speech when you were inducted into the club. But rather than give a speech, Irving Berlin didn't want to give a speech. He composed a song, and he performed a song when he was inducted into the Friars Club, and it was just called the Friars Song. And I looked in the footnotes, and it said that they had gotten that from a guy named Miles Kruger, who was run something called the Institute of the American Musical here in Los Angeles. So I was able to track down Miles, and he had, like, I don't know if it was a 78 record or an acetate or whatever it was, but he had this Irving Berlin pressed recording that he had done of the Friar Song that he had never listened to it. I don't think it had ever been listened to before. And he transferred that and digitized it for me. And I was able to use a snippet of that in the documentary, which, you know, to hear Irving Berlin singing from 1912 when he got inducted into the club, that sort of kind of brings you that era to life of the club, for me at least. But there was quite a bit of history in like various libraries that could be gleaned. And I find, you know, certainly some old photographs from the George M. Cohan days. And Berle almost went back that far. You know, some of his anecdotes went back quite far. So there were some people to get some firsthand stories from.
So how did the documentary get finished? I know one hurdle you faced was when you initially started filming, you had wanted to do it on film, and then somebody had advised you against doing it on film, to do it on tape. And what was the story behind that? I know there was a bit of an interesting technical issue there.
Yeah.
With the networks.
That's why, yeah, I always loved the look of film more. And I had a film school background. And in film school back at that time, I went to NYU, we used 16mm. And I thought that these stars deserve to sort of have that sort of prestigious film look rather than, you know, video. And the very first thing we filmed was an event at the California Friars Club honoring Tony Martin and his wife, Sid Charisse, who was a big MGM musical star who danced with Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire in a number of movies and was a big, 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 big Hollywood star. And I filmed that with a 16mm camera and quickly learned the sound equipment was so clunky. Everything was so clunky. It was so expensive to process film. It was just never going to work. So I think it might've been James Mole, the same guy that hooked me up with my camera person that said, it's just not practical to use film, but there's processes, that you can run video through to give it a film look. So that's what we ended up doing there was a company actually called Film Look at that time. And now it's something that's very standard. You can do on almost any editing software. You can give something a film look, but at the time it was kind of a process.
I understand HBO put up some money to finish the film.
That's what happened. Yeah. Basically I was doing it on my own dime for a very, very long time. And then we got our sizzle reel. I was working with a friend of mine who at DreamWorks actually named Dolores Gavin, who's now a big executive in the world of nonfiction television. And she got it to Sheila Nevins and Nancy Abraham at HBO documentary division, which was like the cream de la creme. And we didn't hear back for a long, long time. We thought it was dead. And then one day Dolores got a call from Nancy Abraham and she was interested. And we had a nice lunch with Sheila and Nancy at the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills, I remember. And they basically said they had a series on Cinemax called Real Life, and they thought it would be great for Real Life. HBO and Cinemax are sort of not parent companies of each other, but partners of each other. And they ran both documentary divisions. So basically, they gave us the finishing funds to sort of pay for all the music licensing and all the clip licensing and all that kind of thing. That without that money, we never would have been able to finish it or afford any of the bells and whistles that are in the documentary, so to speak.
So you've already touched on this a little bit, but talk about when you did a premiere for the documentary with an audience. Who were some of the people that turned out to support you at the premiere? What do you remember about those evenings where you screened it for an audience?
Well, I remember we did one in New York first because HBO's documentary division was based in New York. So we had one at the HBO headquarters that they sponsored. And that one was funny because it was Alan King, I think, was going to introduce the film and something came up and he couldn't make it. And Freddie Roman introduced the film. I just remember my parents came to that. And it was very funny because my parents had no interest in show business. They were both, like I said, I came from a very kind of blue collar background. My dad was a cop and had no interest in show business whatsoever. But Abe Vigoda showed up to my screening and Abe Vigoda played a cop on Barney Miller, a detective.
Right.
And my dad... I've never seen my dad so excited. He ran over to Abe Vigoda to introduce himself, and then he pulled me over to introduce me to Abe Vigoda. I thought that was so funny. This guy that never gave any care in the world to show business was so impressed, so excited to meet Abe Vigoda, and to see my dad that happy made me happy. Art Buchwald showed up, the famous columnist, I remember. I think Jackie Martling was there, and he talked about it the next day on Stern. Soupy Sales, I think, showed up. And then the California one that we had, it was Burl, Norm Crosby showed up, Jerry Vale, Jeff Ross, a handful of others. So that was just, it was very exciting.
You mentioned Jackie Martling, and I know Janine Garofalo is in it.
Yes.
I know Jeffrey Ross speaks quite extensively about the Friars Club, and Jackie Martling, of course, was very big on the Howard Stern show.
Yeah.
Was there sort of a struggle to try and find some younger voices to talk about the Friars and younger people who were involved with the club?
There was definitely, it wasn't a struggle because the younger people definitely wanted to talk and wanted to be in it, but there was definitely an impetus to get younger faces in it because before HBO came on board, I tried pitching it around to Comedy Central and other places. And it's just a sad reality of show business. When something's about older entertainers, nobody really cares. Nobody's going to throw up, nobody's going to put up the money. Nobody's excited to put it on the air. It's, Milton Berle's name meant the world to me, but it didn't mean anything to Comedy Central, which was something, that was kind of disillusioning to learn in my 20s that these great stars couldn't sell a TV show, a documentary even. So yes, that then it was like, you know, how can I populate this documentary with some younger faces? Because that might help in the sales effort, you know, and it turned out to be great because Jeff Ross obviously is an old soul like yourself and like myself. And he loved all these older comedians and was even more integrated into their lives than I became. And Susie Essman gave us an interview. I think it was even pre-Curb or she had just started on Curb. I can't remember. And like you mentioned, Janine Garofalo had just joined the club and I'd seen her talking about the club on a episode of Conan O'Brien. So I went after her. So yeah, there was definitely, it was definitely, something I wanted. I wanted to represent the younger people at the club too. There was an article at the time, in the New York Observer, which was a newspaper. I don't even know if it still exists anymore because I don't live in New York any longer. But there was an article about the club at that time, and the headline was "Take These Kids, Please." And it was all about all the younger kids. It for a quick second, it became popular for all younger people to join the club. And I think Jon Stewart and Jimmy Fallon and, you know, certain people, younger comedians were joining the club, and it was getting some press. So that became part of what I wanted to show also.
Yeah, definitely. And I've tried to showcase that a little bit on the podcast as well. But, you know, I think the beauty of the era we live in now is that I think when you were doing your documentary, I guess it, what is it, almost 25 years ago now?
Yeah.
It was probably a lot more difficult to sell a cable network on a film featuring a lot of older faces. But now nostalgia has become such a big thing.
Yes. And, yeah, it's nice to see.
Have sort of gained a second wave with streaming services and what have you. I mean, Carol Burnett, they just did the big 90th
birthday
special for her. That was
incredible, yeah.
So I feel like we're in an era now where there is an appreciation for people of an older generation. One of my favorite shows is the Autopsy Show on the Reels channel.
Right.
Where they talk, they basically profile the lives of these great Hollywood stars. You know, everybody from Audrey Hepburn to Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin.
Honestly, not to age myself, but YouTube wasn't really a thing 25 years ago. YouTube has changed the game because now kids can find Don Rickles and these comedians are undeniably the funniest people that ever lived. If you find a YouTube clip of Don Rickles, you're going to laugh. If you find a, you know, like, so kids are finding this stuff in, you know, in, and you're seeing, you know, my daughters are on TikTok. I'm seeing these comedians pop up on TikTok because they're so funny. It just, it's inevitable. They're so talented and so incredible.
So you finished the documentary. What was next for Dean Ward? Once the Friars Club documentary, Let Me In, I Hear Laughter was completed, and you put that film in the Dean Ward film archive, where did you go next?
Well, what's funny is when I went to film school, I think I thought I was going to be a director, but I realized I was a little too introverted to be a director. I don't like to boss people around on set and that sort of thing. So right. I started gravitating more towards writing. And what I realized is while making the Friars Club documentary, I was a maniac in terms of the research. And I had all these spreadsheets of like every roast joke that had ever been written about the Friars Club in any book or biography. And it was like a 20-page spreadsheet. And I think by osmosis, roast jokes are like, to me, the purest form of comedy. It's a setup punchline. And if you can learn the structure of that, I think you can learn comedy writing. So by osmosis, I sort of learned the art of comedy writing. And the documentary, because it was such a great conversation piece in meetings, people were always curious about meeting, you know, my stories about meeting Milton Berle and hanging out with Buddy Hackett and Joey Bishop. I started to get jobs as a comedy writer, which was incredible. And, you know, I worked on The Soup, which at that time was called Talk Soup, with a host named Aisha Tyler. And I worked on a Penn and Teller show. And I eventually, I also worked a lot as a screenwriter, but TV was sort of my bread and butter. I eventually started working for Chelsea Handler, writing for Chelsea Lately, which if you've ever seen that, is basically a pop culture roast show. And I worked on her Netflix show and various things over the years, including when she just recently hosted the People's Choice Awards back in January. And she's incredibly fun to write for because she's not from that era, but she's somebody that loves a good setup punchline joke and can deliver it, and, you know, could have held her own with the Burles and Hacketts of the world if she had to. So she's really fun to write for. And so the documentary really sort of opened the doors of the comedy world to me in a way that gave me a career as a comedy writer, which I'm grateful for.
Now that you've been doing comedy writing, where do you hope to go from here? Do you have any other big projects that you hope to get off the ground in the future on the scale of the Friars Club documentary?
I'm always working on stuff. My passion projects are always related to old Hollywood and show business. I make my living usually in contemporary TV, but I'm working on a podcast right now with the estate of a major songwriter that I can't talk too much about yet, but it's sort of delves into the old history of MGM musicals and some stuff relating to that era of show business and that area of musical films. I'm always pitching roast shows. I'm working on various screenplays. I've done some screenwriting work for the Sinatra Estate, which was like the thrill of a lifetime. I got to work with Tina Sinatra, Frank's daughter. That was really fun. So I'm just always sort of juggling the stuff I do to sort of pay the bills and television with my passion projects, which are always about old Hollywood and old show business. For whatever reason, I can't shake the habit, and I don't want to.
It's the perfect time to be doing it. I get, like I was saying, we're in this sphere now where all of this material is having a second life, and all these stars are sort of enjoying a second wave of popularity, and it's admirable what you're doing, and I owe you a debt of gratitude for doing this documentary, because it gave me confidence in my dream to basically do this talk show about the Friars Club. You know, I always loved watching Johnny Carson clips, but I loved where his interviews, where it's basically, yeah, you know, show business people talking shop, and I always enjoyed that, and I sort of wanted to capture that a little bit in doing this show, because the Friars Club features so many people who like doing that and who are of that era. You really did inspire me in a way, so I thank you for that, Dean.
I admire what you're doing, and it gives me hope and optimism that the history of the club's in good hands, and that the club will survive, and people will continue to learn about the history of the Friars Club, because it's very, very important part of the history of show business.
Well, why do you think, Dean, after all this time, that the Friars Club still is a source of fascination to so many people inside the business, outside of the business? Why do you think that it's held on for so many years?
Well, everybody loves the entertainers that have traipsed through the years. And everybody loves roasts. I think there's something intoxicating about roasts. And I know Comedy Central has branded themselves as the place of roasts, but nobody will ever replace the Friars Club as the brand.
Got into the game because of the Friars Club.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, nothing against the Comedy Central roasts. I love them. But to me, the Friars Club roasts can't be topped, because it was friends roasting friends. It was real camaraderie. These people had a history. They loved each other. And that to me is funnier than picking some sort of celebrity of scandal or a train wreck and destroying them. I like when a roast is friends roasting friends, and there's a warmth and a camaraderie behind it. And that to me is what a Friars Club roast is.
Well, Dean, all I can say is thank you so much for being on the show. It has been an honor to talk to you, and you've been a great guest. And I do hope that maybe you'll come back again in the future, and we'll continue our little correspondence, because it's been a pleasure getting to know you through this show. So thank you for all of your support, and for being a fan, and for being a friend, as the Golden Girls might say.
Yeah, thank you, Joe, and I'll continue to be a listener.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.